Good morning on a very spring-like February 18th. This is Jane reading for you from the Herald and Review of Decatur. And I thought we would start today with the big national but also local Illinois news, the death of Reverend Jesse Jackson. The Reverend Jesse L. Jackson, a protege of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and two-time presidential candidate who led the civil rights movement for decades after the revered leader's assassination, died Tuesday. He was 84. As a young organizer in Chicago, Jackson was called to meet with King at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, shortly before King was killed, and he publicly positioned himself thereafter as King's successor. Sunita Jackson confirmed that her father, who had a rare neurological disorder, died at home in Chicago surrounded by family. Jackson led a lifetime of crusades in the United States and abroad, advocating for the poor and underrepresented on issues from voting rights and job opportunities to education and health care. He scored diplomatic victories with world leaders, and through his Rainbow Push Coalition, he channeled cries for black pride and self-determination into corporate boardrooms, pressuring executives to make America a more open and equitable society. And when he declared, "I am somebody," in a poem he often repeated, he sought to reach people of all colors. "I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be young, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody," Jackson intoned. It was a message he took literally and personally, having risen from obscurity in the segregated South to become America's best-known civil rights activist since King. Quote, "Our father was a servant leader, not only to our family, but to the oppressed, the voiceless, and the overlooked around the world," the Jackson family said in a statement posted online. "We shared him with the world, and in return, the world became part of our extended family." Fellow civil rights activist Reverend Al Sharpton said his mentor, quote, "was not simply a civil rights leader. He was a movement unto himself. He taught me that protests must have a purpose, that faith must have feet, and that justice is not seasonal, it is daily work," Sharpton wrote in a statement, adding that Jackson taught trying is as important as triumph, that you do not wait for the dream to come true, you work to make it real. Despite profound health challenges in his final years, including the disorder that affected his ability to move and speak, Jackson continued protesting against racial injustice into the era of Black Lives Matter. In 2024, he appeared at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and at a city council meeting to show support for a resolution backing a ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war. "Even if we win," he told marchers in Minneapolis before the officer whose knee kept George Floyd from breathing was convicted of murder, "it's a relief. Not victory. They're still killing our people. Stop the violence. Save the children. Keep hope alive." Jackson's voice, infused with the stirring cadences and powerful insistence of the Black Church, demanded attention. On the campaign trail and elsewhere, he used rhyming and slogans such as "hope, not dope," and "if my mind can conceive it, my heart can believe it, then I can achieve it," to deliver his messages. Jackson had his share of critics, both within and outside the Black community. Some considered him a grandstander, too eager to seek out the spotlight. Looking back on his life and legacy, Jackson told the Associated Press in 2011 that he felt blessed to be able to continue the service of other leaders before him and to lay a foundation for those to come. "A part of our life's work was to tear down walls and build bridges. And in a half century of work, we've basically torn down walls," Jackson said. "Sometimes when you tear down walls, you're scarred by falling debris, but your mission is to open up holes so others behind you can run through." In his final months, He received 24-hour care. He lost his ability to speak, communicating with family and visitors by holding their hands and squeezing. I get very emotional knowing that these speeches belong to the ages now, his son Jesse Jackson Jr. told the AP in October. Jesse Lewis Jackson was born October 8, 1941, in Greenville, South Carolina, the son of high school student Helen Burns and Noah Lewis Robinson, a married man who lived next door. Jackson was later adopted by Charles Henry Jackson, who married his mother. Jackson was a star quarterback on the football team at Sterling High School in Greenville and accepted a football scholarship from the University of Illinois. But after he reportedly was told black people couldn't play quarterback, he transferred to North Carolina A&T in Greensboro, where he became the first-string quarterback, an honor student in sociology and economics, and student body president. Arriving on the historically black campus in 1960, just months after students there launched sit-ins at a whites-only lunch counter, Jackson immersed himself in the blossoming civil rights movement. By 1965, he joined the Voting Rights March King led from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama. King dispatched him to Chicago to launch Operation Breadbasket, a Southern Christian Leadership Conference effort to pressure companies to hire black workers. Jackson called his time with King a phenomenal 4 years of work. Jackson was with King on April 4, 1968, when the civil rights leader was slain. Jackson's account of the assassination was that King died in his arms. In 1971, Jackson broke with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to form Operation PUSH, originally named People United to Save Humanity. The organization, based on Chicago's South Side, declared a sweeping mission from diversifying workforces to registering voters in communities of color nationwide. Using lawsuits and threats of boycotts, Jackson pressured top corporations to spend millions and publicly commit to diversifying their workforces. The constant campaigns often left his wife, Jacqueline Lavinia Brown, the college sweetheart he married in 1963, taking the lead in raising their 5 children, Santita Jackson, Yusuf Du Bois Jackson, Jacqueline Lavinia Jackson Jr., and 2 future members of Congress, U.S. Representative Jonathan Luther Jackson and Jesse L. Jackson Jr., who resigned in 2012 but is seeking re-election in the 2026 midterms. The elder Jackson, who was ordained as a Baptist minister in 1968 and earned his Master of Divinity in 2000, also acknowledged fathering a child, Ashley Jackson, with one of his employees at Rainbow PUSH, Karen L. Stanford. He said he understood what it means to be born out of wedlock and supported her emotionally and financially. Despite once telling a black audience he would not run for president, quote, because white people are incapable of appreciating me, Jackson ran twice and did better than any black politician had before President Barack Obama, winning 13 primaries and caucuses for the Democratic nomination in 1988, 4 years after his first failed attempt. His successive left supporters chanting another Jackson slogan, "Keep hope alive." I was able to run for the presidency twice and redefine what was possible. It raised the lid for women and other people of color, he told the AP. Part of my job was to sow seeds of the possibilities. Jackson also pushed for cultural change, joining calls by the NAACP members and other movement leaders in the late 1980s to identify black people in the United States as African Americans. To be called African Americans has cultural integrity. It puts us in our proper historical context, Jackson said at the time. Every ethnic group in this country has a reference to some base, some historical cultural base. African Americans have hit that level of cultural maturity. And while we're still in Illinois, something from Springfield. Uncertainty to cloud Pritzker's budget speech. Democrats look to play defense amid volatile Fed funding landscape. Governor J.B. Pritzker will stand in front of the General Assembly on Wednesday in a familiar position, confronting tremendous uncertainty over the state's financial future. Pritzker will present his eighth budget as he seeks re-election to a rare third term and becomes a growing national presence as a possible 2028 presidential candidate and one of President Donald Trump's loudest critics. The Trump administration has put Illinois and other states whose leaders disagree with his vision in the crosshairs, targeting them for massive cuts to federal funding. In the last 2 months alone, that has included a $1 billion child care funding cut that's temporarily been blocked by the courts, and a $100 million in threatened health care funding cuts. At the same time, the economy has been shaken by Trump's tariff policies, and Congress passed a sweeping domestic policy bill known as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that will alter the fiscal landscape for states across the country. That measure cuts eligibility for Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, increases administrative costs, and reduces what the state can collect in provider taxes. The ever-changing federal funding landscape presents lawmakers and Pritzker with a murky picture of the future, one that can change as fast as the president can send a social media post or a judge can issue a restraining order. But the state constitution requires lawmakers to pass a balanced budget, and Pritzker will outline his plan for one on Wednesday. His annual budget address sets up months of negotiation, mostly between supermajority Democrats. They'll try to balance their desires to fund programs while revenues, both from the feds and the state's base sources, are projected to flatten at best. Representative Cam Buckner, a top House Democrat budget negotiator from Chicago, said one of the goals of this year's budget will be to play defense. "It's hard when the biggest variable in the budget is not something that you can control," he said, referring to federal funding. "And with this president, the volatility isn't a possibility, it's a given." Pritzker and his team have already started setting expectations for a conservative budget, telling agency leaders in memos and signaling to legislators that it will be difficult for the state to fulfill funding requests this year. The governor's Office of Manage and Budget estimated in October that lawmakers will have to close a $2.2 billion deficit for fiscal year 2027, which begins July 1st. Much of that deficit is driven by the state's own spending exceeding projected revenue. But the GOMB projected changes at the federal level are making the problem more challenging and will further exacerbate deficits in coming years. In the short term, Pritzker's budget office estimates income tax revenue for the state will be lower because federal tax code changes and some administrative costs for food assistance programs will be required this year. Most of the impacts of Trump's big bill won't be felt until fiscal year 28, but that doesn't mean it won't factor into this year's process. You can't ignore what is coming down the road, and so we should expect and work towards a proactive plan for next year's gap, starting now, not after May, because the gap is being driven by forces that won't wait for the spring, Buckner said. Dwindling federal funding is already starting to appear in the state's balance sheets. The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability's January report shows revenue was 3% lower in January compared to the same month in 2025, largely because of decreased federal funding. Federal funding to Illinois has declined for three consecutive months, though the commission cautioned that there could be a variety of reasons for that, such as the timing of payments. In any case, federal funding was 35% lower this January than last and is now down 8% for the year. Overall revenue for the year is still up 3.5%. It's not just federal funding that presents a challenge for lawmakers. The overall health of the economy does as well. A forecast by Moody's Analytics released last week set an ominous tone. Illinois' economy is in a precarious spot, and a weak economy ultimately makes it difficult for revenue to grow naturally. Potential budget shortfalls in Illinois and the city of Chicago mean lawmakers may need to consider a mix of revenue enhancements and spending adjustments, measures that could ultimately stifle consumer spending, the report said. The forecast predicts employment will not grow or decline, and the economy will grow at a slower rate than other states because of out-migration, a shrinking tax base, and a massive long-term pension liability. Additionally, tariffs are hurting the state's manufacturers, and rural areas are suffering from both tariffs and higher farming costs. Illinois has a lot at stake, given its reliance on manufacturing and logistics and its above-average exposure to foreign trade, the report said. Moody's said the results of Trump's big bill will be mixed by region, but the overall impact of the policy will be negative because it weakened social services. More broadly, Moody's notes an artificial intelligence bubble in the stock market could burst and trigger a recession. Lawmakers could also consider taking proactive steps to absorb new healthcare costs and cuts set to take effect in the coming years. Under a provision in Trump's big bill, one that applies only to states like Illinois that expanded Medicaid eligibility under the Affordable Care Act, a 6% cap on the tax Illinois can charge healthcare providers will gradually be cut starting fiscal year 28 until it reaches 3.5% in fiscal year 32. When the lower cap is combined with a decline in federal aid for Medicaid, the state could lose $1.7 billion annually by fiscal year 31, according to the governor's budget office. The impending limits on Medicaid provider taxes will pose a significant challenge for lawmakers who will either have to find some other way to pay the state's share of the cost or adjust the program to fit within the new fiscal constraints. Since the federal changes do not take effect for another year, it is possible lawmakers will not feel pressure to take immediate action in the upcoming legislative session. The October GOMB report also revealed the state was on track to run a small deficit in the current fiscal year ending June 30th, largely because the state's income tax code was tied to the federal level and Congress made changes that will ultimately lower tax revenue flowing into Illinois. In response, lawmakers decoupled the state's tax code from the federal government in certain areas, which the government, the GOMB, expects to reduce the deficit by $243 million. The state still faces a $587 million deficit because of federal tax changes. Pritzker also asked several state agencies to reserve nearly $500 million in spending because of uncertainty over how revenue will shake out as federal funding remains in flux. The reserves largely focus on cost savings, such as foregoing hiring in certain agencies for the remainder of the fiscal year, reducing available grants, and saving money on health insurance costs. In the last two budgets, Pritzker and lawmakers have also relied on targeted tax increases. Though the fiscal year 26 budget ultimately amounted to a $2 billion spending increase, most discretionary spending outside core areas increased by less than 1%. Pritzker also warned lawmakers last year that if they want to increase spending for a certain program, they must come up with a corresponding cut. Pritzker has also opposed broad tax increases, such as statewide sales and income tax hikes. Senate Republican leader John Curran, a Republican of Downers Grove, said at a news conference earlier this month that he expects limited spending to continue in this year's proposal. Quote, "You saw the rollback on the health care for working-age population for undocumented immigrants last year," Curran said. The Health Benefits for Immigrant Adults program was launched in 2021 and covered qualifying individuals aged 42 to 64, but was ended in this fiscal year's budget because it far outstripped initial estimates. That was something that the governor in his budget address readily admitted, that it was a mistake to go down that road, and the state could not afford that, Curran said. So I think that process already started last year. I expect that to continue this year in this budget. A group of progressive Democrats want to raise taxes substantially to fill the gaps in the budget. The $4 billion tax package calls for taxing the appreciation of billionaires' assets and a 10% tax on digital ads, increasing taxes on corporations' offshore earnings, and closing loopholes in the corporate tax code. Lawmakers said at a news conference earlier this month that the taxes are necessary because businesses and wealthy Americans have benefited from tax policies in Washington. If we don't fight back with taxing the ultra-wealthy, we're going to continue to chop services in order to balance budgets, Senator Corina Villa, a Democrat of West Chicago, said. Speaking to CNI, Buckner said any new revenue must be reliable for the state beyond 1 year and fair to taxpayers so they are not the default state ATM. We've got to create some certainty in this chaos, and that means that we have to build budget that can take a hit without passing the pain straight to families, hospitals, schools, and local governments, Buckner said. Representative Amy Ehlich, a Republican of Godfrey, who leads budgeting for House Republicans, framed concerns about federal funding differently. In my opinion, she said, it is always volatile because you are relying on another level of government with programs that they may begin or end, Ehlich told Capital News Illinois. Ehlich said Republicans are worried Democrats will go to the taxpayers' well for more money. They're not even ashamed or embarrassed anymore to say we need to raise taxes, Ehlich said. And so when they've got so many people on board with that theory and concept, I'm very, very concerned. Republicans in the House have largely been shut out of budget negotiations for several years, and Ehlich said she doesn't expect this year will be different, adding Republicans won't agree to vote for a budget before it is completed. The House Democratic Women's Caucus said in a statement that they are hoping to see the governor boost funding for social services that have been cut at the federal level and are, quote, open to potential revenue options that do not negatively or disparately impact the vulnerable populations we represent. Now a couple news items locally from Decatur. Two rescued from burning home. Two people were taken to hospital Tuesday after being rescued from a burning home. Decatur Fire Chief Neil Elder said crews were dispatched at approximately 8:30 a.m. to a home in the 1500 block of East Vanderhoof Street. He said a passerby reported smoke coming from the home, and there were concerns that occupants were trapped inside. The first arriving units immediately initiated a primary search for the reported victims while additional crews deployed an attack hose line and began ventilation operations to support the search efforts, Elder said in a news release. Two victims were located inside the residence, removed from the structure by firefighters, and transported to a local hospital by Abbott Ambulance. Their conditions are unknown at this time, Elder added. The fire chief said once the rescued victims were safely out of the way, his crews quickly brought the fire under control. He said the cause of the blaze was under investigation, and in a news release, urged families to take adequate safety precautions in their residences. The Decatur Fire Department reminds all residents to ensure they have properly installed and functioning smoke detectors in their home. And now some news about the county fair, which the headline says is growing each and every year. Rodeo, Demo Derby, and Baker Blankenship, part of the 2026 program. It's time to start thinking about the Macon County Fair, and we are actually starting earlier again this year, said Wendy Harned, Fair Board member. The 2026 Fair will mark its 170th season. The fair will open on Monday, June 1st, with popular activities rounding out the week-long festival on Sunday, June 7th, at the Macon County Fairgrounds, 3700 West Northwest Lawn Avenue in Decatur. In the past, the grandstand events would begin on Wednesday. We had some opportunities to move some things around, Harned said. The Downstate Classic Harness Racing, one of the more popular events, will open the fair on the first day. The race is the largest downstate paying purse, according to the fair board. Harness racing will continue on Tuesday with the Standard Bred Association races. Wednesday's grandstand event will be the Macon County Fair Queen Pageant. It's a growing part of our fair, Harned said. A return to the fair is a musical act to the grandstand. Country artist Baker Blankenship will be on stage Thursday. He's an up-and-coming artist, Harned said. You're going to want to see him now. The rodeo, demolition derby, and truck and tractor pulls have been a staple with the county fair, the same grandstand events that everybody asks for every year. The carnival and food vendors have kept the schedule from years past and will open to the public on Wednesday. The board has been working on other updates to the fairgrounds, including new water lines and a remodeled 4-H building and the FFA food stand. The cattle show will return, and the poultry, goat, and rabbit shows continue to grow, Harned said. The fair attendance has grown as well, with approximately 10,000 visitors last year. We try to add acts and new things to the grandstand, so we're growing each and every year. The board has been working throughout the year to prepare the annual fair. Everybody thinks we just put on a fair, she said, but all year long we're consistently doing things throughout the community. Safety is a priority for the fair board and staff. Last year the board added extra security. Children under 17 years old are required to have adult supervision. The Macon County Fair is the first county fair to kick the season off, which immensely helps, Harned said. With a focus on agriculture, the fair has a large number of cattle competing. We had so many last year that we almost outgrew the grounds, Harned said. And for the poultry and the rabbits, there's been over 200 entries. Agriculture is important for the growth of the fair, according to the board. That's what we need to continue to grow the fair and teach people and bring those communities out to see what Macon County has to offer. You can contact Donette Beckett at 217-421-6983. And let's end Decatur News with a little article on cheerleading camp, a family tradition at St. Teresa. Mackenzie Grammer loves cheerleading, and she's passed that love on to her little sister Audrey. It's been pretty fun, Mackenzie said. I love to see her like this. She's been at it for a couple of years, and I love to see her getting better at doing the cheers and interact with all her little friends over here. St. Teresa High School's cheerleaders gave up their day off school for President's Day to lead a cheer camp for little girls in kindergarten through fifth grade who attend the Catholic grade schools. The idea, said cheerleading coach Sierra Chapman, is that those little girls will probably go to St. Teresa when the time comes, and the camp will encourage them to be cheerleaders when they get there. Mackenzie is a senior at St. Teresa and has cheered for all 4 years, and Audrey is in her second year of cheer camp. She always says she wants to be a cheerleader when she gets old. For Mackenzie, cheerleading is time spent with her own friends, and it helps build her confidence. Whenever I started high school, I was kind of in my shell. It helps me a lot just feel more confident and open with other people. Also, I love to get the fans excited and hype up the team. I don't know, I just love it. Coach Chapman was a cheerleader when she was in high school at St. Teresa, so in a way she's come full circle, and watching the high school girls, some of whom were in cheer camp when Chapman was a cheerleader, and become cheerleaders themselves, now teaching this group of little girls about the sport, is gratifying and fun to see, she said. It's a fun way to get future Bulldogs involved and get them to come and cheer when they're in high school. The older girls choose some of the simpler sideline cheers they do at the football and basketball games and teach the young girls some dance moves, too, for them to perform in front of a crowd during halftime at the senior night basketball game on Tuesday. It's kind of fun, a little tradition to do, and some of the little girls are cheerleaders for JFL, Junior Football League.